Lecture 13, Late Medieval and Early Modern Views.
Philosophers in the early modern period progressively liberate themselves from their connection with theology and with the authority of the church. Since the theory of natural law had been such a very intricately woven part of the church's understanding of morality, this will require a new stance on the question of natural law. What had been a part of the vast hierarchical vision of the good of the universe descending all the way from God to the lowest creature now becomes a theory in the early modern period which can be a revolutionary ideology for massive transformation of the political and social order. But this does not come about unprepared. I would like to talk in this lecture about the late medieval and early modern approach to natural law, and particularly to some of the reasons within the late medieval period which gave rise to this very different understanding of natural law in the early modern period. In general, this is called nominalism and voluntarism, and that'll be the first of the three topics I cover in this lecture. Secondly, I'd like to spend a little bit of time with a brief revival of Thomism that occurred in the Baroque Age. And then finally, I will turn to one typical example of early modern philosophy, and then I'll continue with other early modern philosophers in the next lecture. First, then, the question of late medieval philosophy, its nominalism, and its voluntarism. I suppose it's to be expected that any good idea will provoke a reaction, and sure enough, in the 14th century, there was a great reaction against the Thomistic synthesis for a variety of reasons. But we can cover this reaction in general by considering nominalism and voluntarism. This is a stance on the famous problem of universals, which we noted earlier in the course of this lecture series, but which really deserves study in its own right. The problem of universals is the question about the reality of essences, the reality of natural kinds. We noted it all the way back as far as the lecture on Aristotle when we were talking about the natural kinds as distinct from one another, whether one species is different from another species by virtue of having a different essence, that is, a genus, a larger group, and then a specific difference, some particular set of traits which are characteristic of that group and that group only. The technical name for this is that each species has its own essence. But are these essences, are these universal terms, merely terms in our language that are used universally? They're used to describe every member of the set we want to describe, but that the burden is on the person speaking to see the similarity, to find a common term, and that these universal terms are nothing more than parts of our speech. Or are these essences something that really belong to things? Is there some foundation in reality that lets us make the distinctions that we make when we articulate different essences for things? The very exaggerated form of these universals is the form found in Platonism, where the ideas, or the forms, are universals that are in fact actually separate, and they exist in a distinct world. And this world is merely a set of imperfect copies of each of those perfect essences. On the other extreme is nominalism, the view that these universal terms are simply universal terms. They are simply universals in our language, but that they don't correspond to anything in reality. What Aquinas had tried to maintain was a moderate realism, a notion that there really is something that is truly common to all the members of a natural kind. The essence doesn't exist in a separate world. The essence, rather, is exactly the same structure in each of the members of the natural kind or the set we're trying to describe. That stance, a moderate realist stance, is what is questioned in the 14th century. It's a radical break from the Aristotelianism and the moderate realism that Aquinas had maintained. And if one makes this radical break, if one denies that there are real essences in things, it will prove absolutely impossible to have a natural law. It will be impossible to argue that because of the structure, because of this common nature, because of this essence that is recurrent in every instance of a set, like all human beings, that we can argue from the set, excuse me, we can argue from the essence of that creature to the moral obligations that unfold as the ways to fulfill or the ways to foster that individual's development. As a typical example of the nominalist movement, I would like to call upon the figure of William of Ockham. This is an English Franciscan, so he's a member of a different religious order than Aquinas was. He taught at Oxford in the later part of the 13th and the earlier part of the 14th century. And he undertook this position of metaphysical nominalism, which entailed the denial of any real essences. Ockham is perhaps most well known to people for the phrase Occam's razor. One is to shave away any unnecessary entities, that for the purposes of explanation, one should seek the simplest explanation possible, and that one should not postulate any hypothetical entities that one doesn't really need to explain this. Occam's razor is really a two-sided razor. Namely, it does allow us to shave away any unnecessary entities, but it also requires that we postulate a hypothetical entity, which we cannot do without. If we need it really for an explanation, then we may use it. In fact, we must use it. But if we can explain it in a simpler way, we should. Now, Ockham is not the one to invent this, although the device is usually given the name Ockham's razor. Aquinas, and in fact many figures before Aquinas, had used it. But it's a wonderful principle of parsimony that urges us to simplicity in our explanations and not to produce any unnecessary hypotheses that we really don't need. And that's a very good rule for all of science and all of philosophy. The question at issue, though, is about real essences. Should we save those essences, or should we shave away those essences by this principle of parsimony? There's no need, I think, for Aquinas or for Ockham to say that these essences are really separate in the way that Plato thought that they were really separate in a distinct world. The question, however, is not that. The question is whether there has to be a foundation in things, an essence, a natural kind, in order to generate these moral obligations. If we find that there are no essences, if Ockham is right, how will we generate any theory of morality? And that's where the second big idea comes in, namely the notion of voluntarism. Where Thomas Aquinas's theory of the natural law had been a very intellectualist vision, that is, it was God's mind who, in his providence, created these natures with a built-in end and a built-in directedness toward that end, and then it was the human reason, the human intellect, which was to reflect upon this nature and to try to discover what that natural end-directedness was. Very intellectual process. For Scotus, and then for Ockham, whom we are speaking about here, there's a voluntarism, namely a sense that one cannot depend upon our own human reason for the source of morality. And in fact, one may not depend upon the divine reason for the articulation of morality. Rather, one must depend upon the divine will. It is because this is the command of God and God's choice that things are moral or immoral. And as further thinkers carry out the implications that are latent within Ockham's idea, it will be not only God's will, but it will even be human will that is the source of obligation. We'll see that by the end of this particular lecture. Now, paradoxically, and I mention this just in order to be fair to Ockham, Ockham does still talk about natural law, and he uses the term natural law in three distinct senses. First, he uses the term natural law to talk about certain things which are unchangeable divine commands that human reason can know about. For example, Ockham has a long discussion on the sixth commandment, never to commit adultery. And yet he never does tell us how we are to know this by merely human reason. Rather, in line with his basic nominalism, his suggestion is that we impose general moral names upon this forbidden practice, which God has forbidden, and it's forbidden because God thought it wrong. Now, either Ockham is being a little inconsistent here, continuing to use natural law when, in fact, his theory has made natural law impossible, or else he needs to invoke some kind of divine inspiration. Maybe we know that adultery is naturally wrong, but we know it not by a natural process of human reason. We know it by God telling us so. This will be an intractable problem for all subsequent nominalism. How do you justify moral obligations as really objective, really universal, and really intelligible if we are unable to know these common natures. And they will wrestle with that throughout the history of nominalism. And yet they want to assert that nominalism for reasons that are understandable. Namely, the things that really exist are all quite individual, all quite distinct from one another. And one doesn't ever find anything that they, strictly speaking, share in existence. Each one has its own existence. So they ask, how can there be such a common nature? Where does it exist? A second sense in which Occam uses the term natural law is to talk about some of those precepts of the divine commands in which there is natural equality. So we, for instance, should respect everyone's life, according to the fifth commandment. We should murder no one. And his idea is that before the fall, before Adam's disgrace, then perhaps human beings could know these things by a natural law, but that after the fall, these natural law precepts are no longer binding on us. That is, we can't see enough of them, we can't understand enough of them to feel the natural law obligation. Hence, what we depend upon and what we trust in is the divine command to explain this to us. In every respect, Occam is at least being consistent here. From his nominalism, there follows a voluntarism with respect to morality. This, however, raises questions of its own. The perplexities that troubled medieval logic were not just questions about how many angels can dance on the head of a pin, a question that no medieval philosopher ever raised. That was one of those canards that the Enlightenment cast upon the Middle Ages to try to discredit it. But they did have really genuine logical problems. They asked, for instance, questions like this. Could God, in his absolute power, have damned Peter and saved Judas? And there they make a comparison between the two apostles, namely Peter, who even though he denied our Lord at one point, nonetheless repented and hence is saved. Judas, who betrayed the Lord, went out and hung himself. And they ask the question, couldn't God in his absolute power have determined otherwise, determined in a way that Judas should be saved and Peter should be damned? Now, in that, I think they are trying to be extremely docile and extremely humble, trying to give us a sense of God's absolute power. At best, when trying to answer that question, they make a distinction, and they say, in his absolute power, of course, God could have. But God has chosen to restrict his power in certain ways, namely, to restrict his power and to allow us our human freedom, so that once we have freely chosen, in the way that Peter did or the way that Judas did, then God now conforms himself to the way in which we have freely acted, so that God will only condemn Judas if he does not repent, and God will save Peter if indeed he sins but then repents. But what they're asking by putting the question that way is the question about, is God in any way restricted? Does the nature of things in any way require that God determine morality in accord with the nature of things? And figures like Occam want to suggest that God's power is in no way limited. Hence, he's a little weaker on whether there could be such a natural law, and is stronger on the notion that things are moral because God said so, and things are immoral because God said so. It's an effort to have a healthy respect for divine power. I think it may be too strong a sense of divine power in my own estimation of this. A third way in which Occam does still speak of natural law, and it's a very interesting way, we've seen in the previous lectures how great a dependence these scholastic thinkers had upon Roman law and on ecclesiastical law. Well, so too, Occam is alert to this awareness of that legal tradition in which natural law has been associated with the jus gentium, or the law of nations. And Occam suggests, in a way that will prove very, very important for the subsequent history of early modern philosophy, that we may call natural law the jus gentium, or law of nations, acting on that law of nations as if it were natural law. Now, this is to insert that word as if, but to do so in order to try to bring out that we cannot ever know the natural law merely by our reason. We at best will know morality because God has commanded it so. But since we find ourselves in a context where there are very diverse laws from very different human communities, and some at least similarities among these different communities in what they have held, perhaps that's our best way of getting at the source of morality from human experience, namely to treat the jus gentium, or the common element within various human communities, as if it were natural law. And yet, to take that as the only sense of natural law would be to evacuate natural law of much of its normal meaning. This, I think, is the situation by the end of the 14th century. The Thomistic synthesis is deeply under attack. Logic is reigning supreme in the universities. Hair splitting is now the order of the day. And this older tradition has come under attack. Is it really intelligible? Can we ever really know these natures? But the Thomistic synthesis has a revival in the Baroque period, namely the 16th century, where certain Dominican thinkers and certain Jesuit thinkers come to the aid of Thomas Aquinas and try to re-understand his own metaphysical synthesis. Among the Dominicans are wonderful thinkers like Cajetan, Bañez, and De Vitoria. De Vitoria is especially interesting because he's alert to the problem of the Indians in the New World and alert to the fact that they are truly human beings and may not be enslaved. And his natural law theory comes precisely in order to handle the problem of the slavery that is being imposed upon certain of the peoples found in the New World. And natural law, he thinks, will give the only adequate defense of these poor people. There are also a number of Jesuits, Bellarmine, Lessius, and Suarez, and I will take Francisco Suarez as my example here. He is the author of a number of works in politics and in morality, as well as in metaphysics. I will concentrate on one particular work called On Laws and God, the Lawgiver. And one can see here a tremendous depth to the Thomistic synthesis that we were explaining. What Suarez tries to do, I think, is sort of to be a Humpty Dumpty, sitting on the fence and trying to recover as much as he can of Thomistic intellectualism, but at the same time to bring in as much of Occam's voluntarism as he can. And he's going to try to do both. We all, of course, remember the problem with sitting on the fence like Humpty Dumpty does, that if you fall off, it's going to be a very nasty display of a shattered egg. Suarez tries his very best, and I appreciate his efforts to try. I'm not sure that he's ultimately successful in all that he undertakes here. What he attempts to do is to say that there is an order of nature, and in this respect he's being a good Aristotelian trying to follow Aquinas, an order of nature on which human reason may reflect in order to discover the natural law. Why? Because that natural order of things, that wonderful hierarchy of beings, is a reflection of God's immutable and rational nature and a reflection of the divine will. And there we're hearing the Occamist sense of this. When push comes to shove, Suarez tends to urge that the obligatory force of natural law is the will of God. And his reasoning is this: law wouldn't be law unless a lawgiver commands it. The lawgiver has to exercise his will in order to make a directive or to make a command. Granting that lawgiver may be reflecting on the natural order of things and may be trying to make the commands of his will reflect the natural order which his reason discovers, but nonetheless the source of moral cogency, the source of the real biting source of obligation of law and morality comes from the will of God. Hence he attempts a two-pronged approach, which is attempting to be intellectualist like Thomas was, and yet is in a way very pragmatic and dependent upon a divine will in order to see that natural law really does have some force of obligation and cogency upon us human individuals. In this respect, I find that Occam is perhaps more responsive to Occam, Suarez is more responsive to Occam and the nominalists than he is to the Aquinas that he's trying to maintain. And he puts the burden of proof more and more on the logician. That is, he wants us to ask that question about divine omnipotence, God's power. And he wants us really to think through carefully the notion that divine omnipotence cannot be limited in any way. He asks, for instance, at one point, wouldn't we be denying God's omnipotence if it weren't possible for God to command us even to hate him? And it's that rhetorical question. I don't think he expects us to give an immediate direct answer, but he asks that question because he has such a strong sense of divine omnipotence. Where this takes Suarez is to a long and elaborate commentary on troubling scriptural passages. Maybe you've reflected in one time or another on that passage in Genesis in which God commands Abraham to sacrifice his son Isaac, or the time when God commands the prophet Hosea to have intercourse with a prostitute. And in asking these question of the interpretation of these passages, Suarez is saying, is God really being reasonable here? Is God conforming himself to the nature of the thing? Or is God asking for something that sure seems to us to be immoral? There are various ways of handling those difficulties. We would probably profit well by a session on scriptural interpretation to think out what the right answer is. My point here is simply to focus on the fact that Suarez is forced to elaborate complexity of response and forced to the position of saying God's will is the source of morality. So that while normally it's wrong to have intercourse with a prostitute, while normally it's wrong to slay your son in sacrifice, God could command the opposite of those things and in no way be acting immorally. Why? Because what morality is what God commands. It's not right already, and therefore God commands it. It is right only because God commands it. When Suarez turns to politics, one finds that he is indebted to figures in the scholastic tradition, people like Nicholas of Cusa, who make natural freedom the basis for political legitimacy. This is a theme which we will see coming out in tremendous detail as we enter the early modern period, namely that unless there is consent by the governed, there can be no political legitimacy. Suarez grounds that on human freedom, grounds that on a sense of the importance of our wills in giving consent to a government, giving consent to an authority, if that authority is to have any moral cogency. This is also to start to treat the concept of the jus gentium, the law of the nations, not as natural law, but rather as simply a record of the voluntary consent which different populations have given to government in the course of their various histories. Hence, one can see a trend that will develop very strongly in the early modern period, beginning here, taking jus gentium, the law of nations, not as equivalent to the natural law, but taking jus gentium in the modern sense of international law, that is, what various governments have now agreed to do in common, and there's no hint of a natural law basis to it. We turn for the last part of this lecture to another figure of the early modern period who represents the split that has occurred within Christianity by this point. The earlier figures that we had been referring to were Catholic figures, but I'd like to turn now to an early Protestant figure on the subject of natural law, because as the church unity was split asunder, we find that there is a need to have each of these traditions take a stance on what the source of morality is. Where the Catholic tradition continued to try to have a philosophical and a revealed source for any moral theology, the Protestant traditions were much less comfortable with using philosophy. The Protestant traditions tended to emphasize Scripture, namely that the faith is determined by the Scripture alone, and that each person, or at least each confession, has to interpret and determine that Scripture. And yet very, very quickly in the course of intellectual history, these various Protestant confessions each found the need to be asking some of the same philosophical questions, to be asking whether one could know anything about natures and whether these natures would tell us anything about morality, especially on those topics where divine command, where the divine legislation didn't seem to express itself. This had traditionally been a place where theology turned back to philosophy and sought for what was equitable, what was equal, and what was fair. The figure I'd like to use as our example here is a Dutch Arminian Calvinist by the name of Hugo Grotius. Grotius saw enormous possibilities in natural law for dealing with the question of international relations precisely in a split Christendom, when you had some confessional Catholic states and some confessional Protestant states and then various forms of Protestantism. Natural law, he thought, would be a wonderful way to resolve some of these international difficulties. His 1625 book, The Law of War and Peace, defines natural law in a manner that at least anticipates, if it doesn't quite yet reach, that stress on human autonomy and human freedom that will be later typical of the deists whom we'll be dealing with in subsequent lectures. His idea here is that law, that the natural law should be considered a dictate of right reason. That is, we should use our reasons where divine law has not spoken and try to find ways that will bring us into conformity with our rational nature as individuals or our social natures, precisely to show how morally base certain patterns of conduct are and how absolutely morally necessary they are. But in the course of reading this next quote, I'd ask you to listen particularly to the way in which Grotius has reversed the direction of God's involvement in this matter. He says, "The law of nature is a dictate of right reason which points out that an act, according as it is or is not in conformity with rational and social nature, has in it a quality of moral baseness or moral necessity, and that, in consequence, such an act is either forbidden or enjoined by the author of nature, God." Notice, this is to suggest that something is wrong and therefore forbidden by God. It's a restriction on divine power, rather than, as the voluntarists had said it, namely, something is forbidden by God and therefore wrong. Grotius is becoming more and more rationalist, but in the effort to become more and more rationalist, he doesn't follow out the lines of the Thomistic synthesis. He rather initiates a line of thinking that will bring us more and more to a secular version of natural law and to the use of natural law as a revolutionary ideology which can transform the political and social order. I think he may well do this because of the scandal of the wars of religion, and the scandal of those wars of religion will provoke Enlightenment thinkers to more and more secular versions of morality. One of the most important but extremely controversial claims that Hugo Grotius makes is that natural law would still have validity, quote, "even if we should concede what cannot be conceded without the utmost wickedness, namely, that there is no God, or that the affairs of men are of no concern to him." Now, this is a very interesting way of putting it. It's asking us to do another one of those thought experiments. In the last lecture, I asked you to do a thought experiment, what if God showed up? But now I'd ask you to do the opposite thought experiment. What if there is no God? Would natural law still obtain? And Grotius asks that question explicitly. Would natural law still be in force if there were no God? And he answers it unequivocally in the affirmative. Namely, even if there were no God who established these natures, even if we returned, as it were, to a now a very secularized version of Aristotle, where there simply are eternal natures, would there still be a natural law? And his answer is unequivocally yes, granted the difficulties of our reason in coming to know what that law is. He's got enough of the Protestant in him to be very worried in the pessimistic Augustinian sense about whether we can figure it out, and yet he's got enough of the rationalist in him to say there would still be such a law, which is at least in principle accessible to us, in principle intelligible. The difficulty is with us, not with the nature of things, and that a rationalism can eventually bring this out. He does this in a way, I think, that is not impious. He is still a believer. But historically, this opens the way to a very secularized version of natural law theory. In some respects, the work of Grotius seems to be an effort to devise a system of natural law that can deduce all of the various truths of moral obligation from just a few self-evident premises. It tries, I think, to remove from us the burden of a lot of inductive work. If you remember our discussions about Aristotle and Aquinas, they were very, very strong on the notion that it takes an awful lot of observation in order to come up with an idea of nature, that one has to do a lot of comparing of the various examples of the individuals within a species to articulate what a real nature is here. And then, if you turn to Aquinas, it takes an awful lot of knowing the natural inclinations that we share with all beings, or that we share with all the animals, or that we share with everyone in the human community. And it takes a lot of reflection inductively upon that experience in order to bring out what the natural law obligation is. For Grotius, I think there's a sense that that's too much metaphysical baggage to be carrying around. And he proposes, I think, a much more strongly deductive system. One will see a trail of this in, say, a Spinoza, where all of ethics is cast in a deductive geometrical mode. Grotius here tries to simply suggest we have to rely upon certain self-evident principles. Again, let me quote briefly from him. "Just as even God cannot cause that 2 times 2 should not make 4, so he cannot cause that that which is intrinsically evil be not evil." Grotius is very happy to reduce the scope of divine omnipotence precisely in order to bring out a highly rationalized system of mathematics or of natural law. There are other ways of handling that problem, namely the suggestion that such contradictions are not in any way restrictions on God's omnipotence. They are simply projections by us of phrases that no longer have meaning. For Grotius, it's a matter of seeing this as a system of deductions and then creating a politics that flows from this. He thinks, for instance, that the right to wage a just war flows directly and immediately from the right to self-defense, and he is willing to even suggest that there can be political absolutisms so long as sovereign and free people consent to them. He offers a natural law justification of slavery and does a tremendous amount in cultivating the notion of jus gentium, law of nations, as international law rather than as natural law in the scholastic sense. In our next lecture, we'll turn to other figures of the early modern period.